Good evening,
everyone. A very good evening. Welcome to Cure Talk's 90th episode. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talks, joining you from India. Nutrition and diet have been a very popular topic on Cure Talks, and today we have Dr. Colin Campbell back again with us to present his research and views on plant-based diet and its enormous health benefits. Our listeners can follow Dr. Campbell's presentation slides on the link that has been provided on curetalks.com. Dr. Campbell is a Jacob Gold Shurman Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry in the Division of Nutritional Sciences at Cornell University and a best-selling author. His first book, The China Study, examines the relationship between chronic illness and the consumption of animal products. His new book, Whole, Rethinking the Science of Nutrition, posits serious problems with the way nutritional research is conducted. My co-host of the evening is CureTalk's Creative Director, Aziz Rawat, and today's topic of discussion is Nutrition, Cancer, and the China Study. Before I hand over to Aziz, I would like to remind our listeners that towards the end of the talk, we will be answering questions sent in via email by our listeners. If you want to ask a question live, please press 1 on your keypad to let us know, and we will bring you on air to ask them. I will now hand over to Aziz. Aziz, you are on air.
Thank you, Priya, and thank you, Dr. Campbell, for being back with us today.
Thank you.
Your last show with us was so informative, and I thought it was such a lively discussion you and Dr. Daniels and Julie had. People need to hear these discussions, and they did. A lot of people listened to it, and it seems we have a lot of people tuning in for this one as well. A big takeaway from your last talk was that the closer we get to consuming a whole food, plant-based diet, the healthier we are going to be. You talked about societies with low consumption of protein and fat also have lowest consumption of cancer and heart diseases. And that, to me, is very interesting because it's totally going against the notion of high-protein diets being good for you that we hear all the time. And I know we have a lot to cover with your presentation, so let's get right into it so we have enough time for some questions after. I just want to remind our listeners that they can follow Dr. Campbell's presentation on the link that has been provided on our website, curetalks.com. So, let's get started. Dr. Campbell, over to you.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Incidentally, I can't see my own slides on the show, so I have copies in front of me. I presume everyone else can see the slides. Is that true?
Yep. Yeah, we can see the slides, yes.
Okay, I'll refer to them as best I can as we go through them. Actually, my talk really concerns my long career in health, diet and health and research. That started, actually, this is my 60th year, 60, that is, when I started my graduate studies at Cornell University. And at that time, I had a certain view about nutrition, which was fairly traditional. That is to say, a diet high in protein and with adequate amounts of fat and so forth, lots of meat, milk, and dairy was the best kind of diet. And it seemed true to me, not only to some extent as a professional as I was beginning to learn it, but also I was raised myself on a dairy farm, and I grew up on a farm that obviously consume this so-called Western diet, high in protein, fat, and so forth. And when I got involved in my research, for the most part in the beginning in the Philippines, when I was there with my senior mentor, organizing a nationwide program that was supposed to be helping malnourished children. And the main theme that we had, other than making sure that these children had enough food, the main theme was to make sure they had enough protein. Also, just prior to that, I had been doing my graduate work. Also, my doctorate work, in fact, on a dissertation, that involved trying to learn some new ways of producing more protein, especially so-called high-quality protein, which means animal protein. And so that was the start of my career. I learned something quite different, as I'll briefly explain here. This is a very, very big topic, and I've published hundreds of peer-reviewed papers and been involved in a lot of research over the years with many students and colleagues. So what I'm going to mention just in these few minutes here tonight is just a few sort of summary comments. So let's look at the second slide. It's a picture, essentially, of some food, whole food, plant-based, if you will, vegetables, fruits, grains, legumes. And what we've learned through the years, and certainly what my laboratory learned quite extensively, was that these foods have a lot more nutritional value than what we had previously known. And so I want to describe first how I really got involved in this. And as I said, one of the first projects that I was involved in was making sure that the malnourished children in the Philippines were getting enough food, especially enough protein. I had a second interest at that time, too. I had an interest in cancer, how it forms, especially liver cancer, which was fairly common in the Philippines and other Asian countries at that time, Asian and African countries, I should say. And I got the impression very early on that among the few families in the Philippines who were consuming the most protein, basically it seemed like their children are more prone to getting liver cancer. And so because we were involved in also the protein story, as I said, and I started putting the two together, and I got this impression that those families who were consuming the most protein might be more susceptible to getting liver cancer, perhaps other cancers as well. So that started a long research career that was funded in the United States by the National Institutes of Health, which is our primary funding agency. And I want to show you then in the third slide, some work that was done in experimental animals that really piqued my interest. As I said, I just had the impression from these children. But this study that came from India in the 1960s, it's labeled dietary protein and AFB1-initiated liver cancer. That's a summary, a very brief summary, of some of this early work that they did. And what they learned was that in experimental animals that had been exposed to a carcinogen that gives rise to cancer, that's a chemical. That chemical is called aflatoxin, and it's abbreviated here, AFB1. When these two groups of animals were fed or exposed to aflatoxin, which causes liver cancer, it's very potent in animals. And so the idea of the Indian workers was to believe that animals fed the higher levels of protein, that's let's say 20% of total calories, they would be less likely to get the cancer, because virtually everyone in those days, and still today, a lot of people believe if protein has exceptional value to create all kinds of good health. In any case, they fed these two different groups either 20% protein, which was the recommended level, compared to the animals given of lower levels, 5%. And although both groups had received the exposure to the the cancer-causing carcinogen, The animals fed the 20% protein, they were the ones, 100% of them, that seemed to have gotten the cancer. And the animals given the lower levels, they did not. Actually, these Indian workers in those days did not quite believe those results, I think, because they did another study where they changed the dosage of the carcinogen and ended up seeing that high protein was protective. But that was a very different situation. It had nothing to do with cancer. It had to do with toxicity. So let's just then quickly summarize this slide. High protein gives rise to more cancer. Well, for me, that was a shock, both personally and professionally, because that's not what we were in the Philippines to do, is to make sure they get... I mean, we were there to give a lot of protein, and here was a problem. So now let's look at the fourth slide. You'll see a chart there that we did some experiments of our own. I wanted to see if these results from India were true, and I wanted to learn something about how this worked biochemically. And so, again, we did a study similar to what the Indian workers had done. Two groups fed either 5% or 20% protein. Both groups exposed to the same amount of the chemical carcinogen. And you can see in the first 12 weeks, their early cancer grew rather well when the animals were fed 20% protein, but did not with the 5%. So that was almost identical to what the Indian workers had done. So then if you go to slide number 5, where it says cow's milk protein and early cancer, you'll see that in that case, what we were doing there was to ask the question, what happens if we change the consumption of protein during the course of this experiment? And so for the first 3 weeks of the experiment, we gave the higher protein, and the liver cancer lesions were growing rather well. We switched it to 5%, we turned it off, back to high protein, we turned the cancer process on again and then off again. And very briefly, what we learned was that, and this was new for those days, it still is new for most people these days, we could turn on and turn off cancer in this particular example simply by changing the level of nutrient intake, in this case protein, of course. So it really gave me the impression rather convincingly that at least for this particular cancer, at least for this particular experimental model, the higher protein diet was really very effective in promoting the development of cancer. So then we went to the next question that I was interested in, and that was to learn something about how does this work? I mean, this idea was so provocative that it seemed, you know, to not be believable, really. And so I started looking at mechanisms and so-called mechanisms, and that's the next slide where I'm asking a question. You'll see the title, What Mechanism Explains High Protein Feeding on Cancer? And in this particular case, that line there is the timeline representing the beginning of cancer over time. At the very early stages, it's called initiation. The next stage, which is much more prolonged, is called promotion. And the last stage, I don't have it listed there, but that's when the cancer becomes pretty advanced, if you will. That's just an experimental model that a lot of us have used in experimental research. And so I wanted to know, you know, how does this protein increase the ability of the carcinogen to actually cause liver cancer? And so we, in the first phase, initiation phase, that's when a mutation occurs, which is traditional, is typical of the beginning of cancer. The chemical actually was a mutagenic agent that causes mutations, and that occurs through some enzyme activity. And so we looked at the enzyme activity that's called MFO, or mixed function oxidase. We looked at a lot of different things to see if we could understand how this worked. And you'll see a list of things there, and I cannot get into that in this particular presentation. But just under initiation, mutation stage, you'll see several items there that we looked at and examined fairly closely and found that when the protein intake was up, that is the 20%, it increased the rate of entry of the carcinogen into the cell. It increased the enzyme activity that actually activated the carcinogen to cause it to, let's say, then bind to the genes, that's DNA. So it increased binding to DNA. It did some other rather fancy things too, and it changed the structure of the enzyme and so forth. So the high protein diet was doing several things to actually increase the risk of that carcinogen causing cancer. So then we said, okay, let's go to the second stage and see what we see there. And there, without getting into the details, we learned some more mechanisms, all of which supported the idea that the higher protein diet turned on cancer. Of that, there was no doubt. For example, in the first instance, it says lower NK cell activity. That's natural killer cell activity. Rather intriguingly, the high protein diet actually compromised the natural ability of the body that it has to kill cancer cells. That's what the NK cell activity means. So the higher protein diet is not only increasing the amount of the carcinogen that's attacking the DNA and increasing mutations, but at the same time, it's actually compromising the ability of the body to block it. Really rather interesting idea. The higher protein diet did a number of other things there you can see listed. I just point your attention to just one thing. That's the IGF-2. That was in the early days, and I think we may have been one of the first to ever look at this, but IGF is an insulin-like growth factor. It's a growth hormone. It's a natural growth hormone. And so it's useful. You know, when we're young, we want to grow, or if we want to repair wounds and so forth, the body has the ability to call on that hormone to help in the development of cells. And in this particular case, though, the higher protein diet was increasing that hormone activity, therefore increasing the rate at which the cells divide and grow, which is fine during normal growth of the body. But unfortunately, when that gets out of hand, it also encourages the growth of cancer cells as well. So I'll just stop here just for the moment, quickly summarize, and say that not only did the high protein diet increase the production of cancer, it did it by a whole bunch of different mechanisms. And now I'm convinced many years later, 20 to 30 years later, that there are many more mechanisms. And there is no doubt in my mind that when we increase the protein intake in the diet, we're going to get these effects. So now let's go to the slide number 8. I don't know if it has the name or not, or that number. But you'll see there a graph showing, it says percent dietary protein on the x-axis, and then there's a cancer index, so to speak, on the y-axis. And what we were interested there was to see what level of protein, you know, caused this phenomenon to occur. I mean, we knew up until this point the 20% of the diet is protein, it turned on cancer. 5% did not. So what we did in this experiment here, we gave 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, and so forth. And we learned something really interesting, which had turned out to be a really quite a momentous idea later, because in terms of its application to humans and in terms of its application to nutrition and health in general. What you can see in this particular presentation is that protein fed up to a level of about 10% of calories, it doesn't turn on the cancer. But as soon as the protein begins to exceed 10%, then it turns on the cancer. Now, if you look on that next slide, I want to tell you that this protein that we were using, and hadn't paid that much attention to it at the time, but the protein we were using was casein, the main protein of cow's milk. So cow's milk protein is turning on this cancer. And of course, for me, that made it really provocative, coming from the farm and believing that, you know, the more protein, the better, and animal protein, or particularly even milk protein, even better than that. Whereas in reality, the casein was actually turning on the cancer. Just to have to jump over a bunch of information here and see if I can describe this adequately, it turns out this relationship, you know, up to a level, the protein doesn't seem to cause any harm as far as this particular situation is concerned. It's only in excess when the protein increases the cancer. So I can't say, and we can't say, that protein causes cancer. That's unfair. I need to modify that statement a bit and say, when protein is fed in excess of the amount we need. Okay? Now, it turns out that we humans, at least in the Western countries for sure, we humans tend to consume, at least 95% of us, we consume in excess of that 10% level, which seems to be safe, you know, a safe level, a good level. But we're really consuming in excess of the 10%. On average, in the United States, we're consuming around 17% of the total, about 70% higher even than that. And it turns out, without showing all the details here, we get that protein from animal-based foods. So we suddenly have here a rather revealing story. That is to say, at around 10%, which this suggests is a good level, it's plenty enough, that 10% is already in excess of the amount of protein we really need for most people. The amount that we absolutely need is around 5 or 6%. It's not that much. But it's been recommended that we consume 8 to 10% just to be on the safe side. That was done many, many years ago. It's been supported by all kinds of research for many years. So the 10% level is a good level. It turns out the 10% level of protein is what we can get from plants. Plants have all the protein we need. And when we're consuming the protein in the form of plants, then we're also changing some other things. We're changing the consumption of lots of other nutrients at the same time. I should tell you, I failed to mention this, that whereas the casein was increasing the cancer, we tried two plant proteins to see if they would do the same thing, soy protein and wheat protein. Neither one did. Even when those proteins were fed at the 20% level, they did not turn on the cancer, which is really kind of interesting. And that sort of raised a whole new generation of questions as well. So if I can just quickly summarize this slide here, up to 10% protein, which can easily be provided by plant-based foods, we're going to get all the good effects of protein. Protein is an essential nutrient. We all know that. We need protein. If we didn't have protein, we'd die. So we need protein. So this entire little story here began to show that although we need protein, we can get it from plants, number one. And number two, we do not need to go higher than that because if we do, we're going to run into other problems. Now, when I say other problems, look at the next slide here, where it says nutrient composition, because what I just said sort of begs the question, you know, what is the nutrient content of plant foods and animal-based foods? And here you can see in this chart that I've just selected five of the major nutrient groups in food, antioxidants and complex carbohydrates and vitamins and fat and protein and so forth. And then I show, you know, where these nutrients come from. Well, it turns out in the plant column, you'll see that the antioxidants, complex carbohydrates, and virtually all the vitamins, the true vitamins, that is, really come from plants. So when we and very little or none of that in animal food, unless the animal was eating some plants at the time and some of it kind of spilled into blood. But in any case, you don't find these kind of nutrients really in animal-based foods. And it turns out the antioxidants, the complex carbohydrates, and the vitamins and so forth, they really inhibit the development of cancer. They prevent heart disease. They have just enormously impressive effects to do all kinds of things. So if I can just, let me go on first and mention the last two entries there. We have antioxidants, complex carbohydrates, and vitamins that are primarily in plants, not in animals. Of course, then plants have fat and protein, and so does animals, of course, have fat and protein. But animal foods, on average, have higher levels of fat and protein than do overall, than do the plants. So when we're eating plants, we're getting a really nice mixture of the good nutrients, and we're getting actually the good levels of the fat and protein. So that, coupled with the fact that we're not consuming the animal-based foods, it makes a big difference. So let's just now just jump there. I put at the bottom of the chart, by the way, a little entry that says processed foods are varied and likely to be worse. And when I'm talking about processed foods, I'm talking about the kind of stuff that we, like cookies and cakes and crackers and all the kinds of things you can buy in the roadside stands and so forth, especially at gas stations and stores. Processed foods are not what I'm talking about. Even though those processed foods might be made up of, let's say, the fat or the oil from plants, and even though it may have the sugar from plants and, of course, salt and so forth and so on, the processed foods don't have all the antioxidants, the complex carbohydrates, and the vitamins that we need. Let's just add it. And that's another whole story. When we add those things back to the food, they do not have the same effect as they do when they're in the whole food. So the processed foods is not what I'm talking about. They're just as likely just to be as bad as animal-based foods. And so this leaves us only one group of foods that really create health. It's the whole plant-based foods. So let me move on to the next slide and just mention quickly some real evidence that we have how this works. And the next slide, you'll see a picture of a man there that says prevent and reverse heart disease, Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn at the Cleveland Clinic. He's a very eminent surgeon, had quite a famous career, good friend of mine. He and I are about the same age, retired about the same time. Well, he, prior to my knowing him, he decided that he wanted to try with some heart patients the effect of this diet for his own reasons. I say we did not know each other. He didn't know my work until he heard about it in the New York Times. But in any case, he had started this in the late 80s. He had a bunch of coronary patients, 18 of them, actually. And he just wanted to give them this kind of diet. And those people had been seriously ill with heart disease. They had had 49 coronary events for the previous 8 years prior to getting into the study. So they were real heart patients with problems. And so they followed him up, just given a whole food, plant-based diet, if you will. And he published his results after, I think it was 4 years, and he got 12 years. I'll make some reference to that here. And then later, as part of a film that he and I were in, he documented some more evidence to show, and he knew at that time, 27 years later, these people had heart disease, and some were told to go home, and the doctor said, we can't do anything for you. He actually put them on this kind of diet and got these amazing results. He stopped heart disease. And he has since published another paper last July in the Journal of Family Medicine, really a wonderful study, much expanded beyond this, where he started with 198 patients that he had counseled at one point, and then came back later, between 2 and 7 years later, and asked them how they were doing. They were all heart patients. And it turned out that later when he contacted them, 177 of 198 had complied. They stayed with the diet. The others did not. And the ones who were compliant that stayed with it, they essentially, among all of them, there was only one coronary event. And those that did not do this, there was 62% had a heart event. So really dramatic differences. So based on Dr. Esselstyn's work and, of course, on Dr. Dean Ornish, who has become very famous in some of the work that he was doing early on, especially in regards to his getting this to the attention of the American public and getting some health care support for these to help doctors in this effort. They have been able to show really quite conclusively that we can now reverse, and I would even use the word cure, heart disease, just with using this whole food plant-based diet. Then there's an addition in the next slide. You'll see a couple of other books there, friends of mine too. Dr. John McDougall, who's been at this game for a long time. He's a physician in California, as well as Dr. Neil Bernard. They have been having their own programs and using this in various ways, and Dr. Bernard has documented a lot of benefits from this from the early 1980s onwards. And again, I didn't know these gentlemen before they were doing this work, but I list them here because both of them have shown that for type 2 diabetics, if you put them on this kind of diet, you get these remarkably good benefits. They go off their medications for the most part very quickly. Now, in the next four slides, I just want to show you that was meant to be one slide. It's supposed to be animated, but it couldn't work here on this program, I guess. What I've listed here is a list of a bunch of different diseases for which there is scientific literature to document the idea that a whole food, plant-based diet is capable of either preventing, stopping the development of, or suspending, and or curing all these diseases. And this particular list is now a short list. The list is actually longer. But I put this list together when my youngest son, Tom, and I wrote the book called The China Study. It came out in 2005, and I had become by that time so impressed with this information. I wanted to see if, you know, we had evidence in this in the scientific literature in years past. And so I went into the literature and looked to see, and I found all these outcomes or diseases that could benefit from this kind of diet. So it demonstrated the idea that this kind of diet is very broad in its effect. I would suggest that it's pretty well now demonstrated. It's a total health effect, creates good health, energizes people, improves their well-being, at the same time prevents all of these diseases or even reverses them in many cases. So the effect is broad. It's also surprisingly rapid. So all of a sudden this diet becomes a means of treatment. It's not just about preventing the diseases. Now we've done this. My own oldest son has done it. Dr. Esselton did it best first on heart disease patients. Dr. Bernard, Dr. McDougall. What we now are learning that if you take a group of people who are generally sick or even feeling like they're okay, but they're not quite there, and if you sort of do some measurements of their clinical biomarkers and so forth, it turns out that within 10 days to 2 weeks, you can see dramatic changes using this approach here, and people get well. And then in the last couple of slides, the next two slides, I'm saying that if this is sustained, and it can be sustained, it requires a sort of a new taste preference to adapt to. And when it's sustained, let's say over a lifetime, then it's a matter of actually getting well. If you're sick and you've got these problems, try this diet and see what happens. Stay with it, and you can enjoy a good long life. Now, let's go to the next slide where it says not low-carb diets. I want to just put in a word about a very popular, it turns out it's quite a popular idea that's been around now for, gosh, maybe 30 years or more. It started with a certain Dr. Robert Atkins, the so-called Atkins diet. Since then, there's been other books that have come out with different names, South Beach, Paleo diet, Zone diet, Blood type diet, Weebly diet. All of these books that have come out, I should say, are not based on science. They're not the kind of books that actually get into the science and present the evidence in that way. They're more sort of reports of what they believe to be true. There's only one in there that attempts to get some respectable science in some ways of the paleo diet, drawing on archaeological evidence to make his case, but it turns out all of these diets are called low carb. And what they're saying is that if we went on a diet really low in carbohydrate, then that's going to be the best of health. And they maintain that heart disease and cancer and so forth, you know, are being caused by the fact that we're consuming too much carbohydrate. Now, to some extent, that's true if we're talking about just sugar, refined carbohydrates. White flour, that's not, as I said before, that's part of the processed food idea. But they just speak of it generally and say if we go on a low-carb diet, we can regain health. And it turns out there is some help if you get off the processed foods, but that's not the solution for the future because if you look at the next two slides, the low-carb diet, in respect to its carbohydrate content, the low-carb diet is around 15 to 20% of total calories. Our whole food plant-based diet, by the way, is 75 to 80%, so it's exactly the opposite. The low-carb diet, if it's only 15 to 20% carbohydrate or somewhere around there, as they generally recommend, what that means is the low-carb diet is really very high in fat and protein. And there is no evidence that the high-fat, high-protein diet sustains long-term health. And certainly if you use a low-carb diet, whereas you might see some benefit, loss of weight in the beginning, for people who are really overweight, in terms of long-term health, it just doesn't work. It's a bad trip. is not going to sustain good health. And in fact, in the next slide, you'll see there it says low carb versus SAD, that's standard American diet. This is some evidence here that was taken from one of the Atkins supporters, essentially. They did a little study comparing the low-carb diet with, let's say, the standard American diet, which is not very good. I mean, we're pretty high in fat and protein, of course, as all of you know. And so they compared the low-carb diet to see what would happen. The results were not favorable. And, in fact, here's a bunch of different entries here showing things like shortness of breath and constipation and other sorts of issues that tend to arise in people at a much higher rate when people are consuming a low-carb diet. And this is evidence from that group. It's not mine. In the next slide, we can see there a plot comparing, let's say, animal protein or combination of animal protein and animal fat for different countries versus breast cancer. Beautiful straight-line relationship. And it turns out that you can see there, and this is evidence that's been around for 30 or 40 years, done a number of different times, the higher the protein, higher the fat from animal-based foods, the higher is the risk for breast cancer. Same also for colon cancer, for heart disease, and so forth. The reason I show that there, because this is really what happens, let's say, in populations that are sustained on these different kinds of diets. In the countries that have the lowest level of protein, lowest level of fat from animal-based foods, they have the least of the diseases. So then I kind of summarize toward the end, and I just simply say a whole food plant-based diet with little or no added fat, sugar, and salt solves more illnesses than all the pills and procedures combined. I mean, I've become really quite enthusiastic for this because I've been in the business for so long. I've seen how the evidence has emerged. I've seen now the results, and I've been both in the human kind studies kinds of thing as well as in the laboratory. And I really have to tell you that the evidence now is really overwhelming that a whole food plant-based diet is the future, not just for regaining health for ourselves, but for a variety of other reasons as well. And then I finish with two slides there, sort of just pointing out that in the next to the last slide, I'm talking about an online plant-based nutrition course that a private foundation that I sort of founded when partnering with the arm of Cornell University that does online courses. We have this online course now called Plant-Based Nutrition. Anyone can take it any place in the world. You just go on nutritionstudies.com. Uh-oh, I see I have the wrong address there. You go, the address, the URL is nutritionstudies.org, and that's been very successful. We offer 30 Category 1 continuing medical education credits or CEU credits for health professionals. And of the 200 and some courses that Cornell University has online, ours is number one. So we've had a lot of success with this. And then I just, the very last slide, I'm just listing there quickly some books that I published, the China study. Actually, my son and I, Tom, my son who did that book with me now is a physician of his own. And we're doing a second edition to that book. So the China study and Ho are the two principal books that I've been involved in. Then there's a couple of cookbooks there, the China study and Plant Pure Nation cookbook. That's a daughter and daughter-in-law. Way over on the right is Campbell Plan. That's my son, who now is a director of a nutrition program at a big medical school. He's had his own book. And then the other two things, the one up in the upper left is a film that just came out. It was shown around the country. It's being shown around the country now at premiered in Hollywood just about a month ago. It's called Plant Pure Nation. And there's one more in there, a daughter doing some stuff too. So in any case, I'm sorry this has been so fast, so superficial. I apologize for that. But I just wanted to kind of touch on the high points that if any of you are in science or you wish to be in science, I can assure you this is a very, very exciting area to be in. It's a rather different kind of science, actually, in many ways, because it challenges a lot of the things that we're now doing. It's kind of a tough journey in some ways, but it has tremendous promise to really resolve a lot of problems we have in our society. So thanks very much, and I'll be happy to take some questions.
Very interesting, and I would love to watch this film. Plant Pure Nation. Okay. Oh, that's going to be on my list now. So, Dr. Campbell, this what I'm hearing is you're basically saying that you can turn the cancer taker back with a whole food plant-based diet, basically. Is that correct?
Well, I got it. Let me be careful on that one. I'm glad you really raised that question up front, because whereas in heart disease, we've had some really pretty good studies done now, and it's been published to show that we can do it with heart disease, and as well, reasonably good studies in diabetes. We have but in cancer, we don't have the formal kind of study that needs to be done. I need to emphasize that. And so for many people in traditional medicine, they're not inclined to want to really believe this or take it too seriously until the formal study is done. But I can tell you the kind of evidence that convinces me that not only is this evidence that we now have sufficient to give it a try, but in many cases, I know of cases that seem to have responded very well to this. In fact, there's a physician in Ireland that I did not know. I still haven't met him. I'm going to be meeting him soon. He was a general practitioner for all of his career, and during the latter 10 years or so of his career, he heard about the China study, our book, and he had diagnosed many of his patients with cancer, and so he was urged to give it a try, to take this kind of information and try it in his cancer patients. He published a book that was published last year, it's really quite remarkable. He was a very conservative doctor, not likely to want to believe this. He tried it with his patients and got remarkable results. Benefits in many cases, I guess you could say cure. And I know of a lot of anecdotal cases. It's not the kind of thing that is going to sell itself, you know, in medical journals for sure, not anecdotal. But on the other hand, because of the basic science involved, which I'm quite familiar with, and also the other kinds of evidence available, I'm saying that this clearly, I think, has the potential to be the solution to cancer, the same as it is for heart disease and autoimmune disease and a few other things.
Okay. All right. So we've got a lot of questions, so I'm going to go through a few of them, and then I'll hand it over to Priya, because she also has a lot of questions that people have sent in. So my first question, I there was something in one of those first few slides of yours. You talked about animals with tumor and hypoplastic nodules. And it made me wonder, what is the possibility that sometimes people could be consuming meat of an animal with tumor or some sort of illness that goes undetected and the animal goes through for human consumption? We know about mad cow disease and all that. And I'm not talking about such a serious casualty, but some less serious casualty perhaps. What is the possibility of that?
Well, actually, that's really not important because let's see, the animal food, even if you were to theoretically consume animal food from an animal that had some of these pre-neoplastic foci, for example, even if you were to consume that, that's not going to give you cancer. What really happens in a case like this is the protein content and the lack of the other nutrients that actually encourage the development of cancer. And all of us have some predisposition for cancer, and that's what causes it. It's not any cancer cells that might be in these animals. That's not it. That's not an issue.
Okay, all right, that's good to know. And one question arises is, were people in the caveman days eating meat and getting cancer and dying younger than we do today, but just didn't know that they were dying of cancer? Would that be something to think about?
Yes. Yeah, of course, it's a good question, and people have posed that question, have, in fact, done the best they can to try to evaluate, investigate, and study it, and so forth. But it seems like from the ancient literature, to the extent we understand that literature, maybe from Egypt, Greece, Rome in particular, it turns out cancer is really quite rare. It really was. It was very rare. The only time that during the late, let's say, 18th, 19th, 20th centuries time. At that time, the people who were getting the cancer, for example, were the royalty. They were the rich, who obviously were eating the kind of food that, you know, that we're now eating today. So the evidence suggests that in those olden times, cancer was rather uncommon, and it certainly was not the cause of early death. That was more likely due to either trauma, which in the very early days, people got killed and so forth, or it was poor. It was infections and things like that.
Okay, so this is a good second, segueing into this another question, which kind of I'm guessing it you kind of answer it, but I'll still kind of pose it to you. So the meat that is available to us today is industrialized and not as pure as it was back in the older days. Also, and it's a lot cheaper to consume meat now than in the older days, where it was, in fact, it was a lot expensive. And like you said, like the royalties were getting it. So maybe because they were consuming a lot more meat than, the common man did. Could that be a big factor contributing to the link between meat and disease, just because having a lot more, as in, because
yes,
what I'm trying to get here is, like, this is good news that, okay, you can prevent heart disease and cancer and diabetes by doing a whole food plant-based diet. But then it's a bit of a bittersweet, because people love meat, right? And then, so if there is, there is a portion maybe that kind of, which they need to eat, in some sort of a balanced kind of a portion that could help them eat what they kind of want to, but in a very limited quantity.
Well, you've asked several different kind of questions here. It turns out it's true. A lot of people love meat, as you say. But keep in mind that we now know, and we've got good evidence for this, that there's a term used for eating addiction. You know, when we're consuming meat-based foods, especially high fat, and in addition, not meat, but sugar, those things trigger an addiction. And so in a sense, we are addicted to the high-fat diet. We are addicted to the simple carbohydrate diet. And it takes a while to get rid of that. That's why so we say to ourselves, oh, this really tastes good because this is what I always ate and so forth and so on. But it kind of crept up on us over time. And we came to like it because we're now addicted to it, and it's hard to give up. In a sense, the same as it is hard to give up cigarettes, or any other kind of chemical addiction. And it just takes time. And what I can say, and I know this for myself and many friends because I made the transition, basically. And that is, if one goes on the whole food plant-based diet without the added fat and sugar, if they go on that, it takes about a month or two, maybe three in some cases. All of a sudden then, not all of a sudden, but we gradually begin to then develop new taste preferences. And so this new diet, that's what we like. And if we go back and try to eat the old, we don't like it. If we do it right, if we use this new whole food plant-based diet for a sufficient length of time to allow our bodies to adjust to it and allow our taste preference to change. So, yeah, we may like it, we may love it and all that, but that doesn't mean that, we're gaining health from it, we're dying from it.
Okay, and my last question is about gut flora. We hear a lot about gut flora these days, fermented foods and food combined in habits these days. What do you have any opinion on that?
Yes, I do. I've been involved in that question for a long time. I should tell you, in the big study we did in China, this is 6,500 people that we surveyed. Their cholesterol levels are all very low by Western standards, very, very low. And I know it's been true for 50 or 60 years in the West, at least, that it's been said that high cholesterol consumption or cholesterol causes heart disease, or saturated fat causes heart disease. Actually, I've not been in favor of that statement because alone, cholesterol is not a major cause of heart disease. But diets high in cholesterol, you know, are associated with heart disease. And when I say they're high in cholesterol, cholesterol only comes from animal-based foods. So what we were looking at is that we saw the association of high cholesterol consumption with more heart disease. That is pretty clear, you know, when you compare different populations. But it's not the cholesterol that's really causing the disease necessarily. It gets involved in it a little bit, but it's not really causing it. What's really causing it is the fact that we're consuming animal protein-based foods, which are wrong in so many different ways. So it's a combination of all of these things working together that causes the heart disease, not cholesterol alone. So the recent controversy that arose, some scientists have gotten together to say, you know, it's not cholesterol. Well, that's kind of opened the door to people to believe that, oh, now the cholesterol story is no longer good. Now we can go back and have butter. We can have this. We can have that. No, not at all. It was never meant to be cholesterol in the first place. It was an overstatement. It's what we learned. It was actually in 1909, the first time, it was shown when cholesterol was compared with animal protein as to which one causes heart disease, which one causes increasing cholesterol. It was animal protein that did that, much more, let's say, than saturated fat. So through the years, we've never really wanted to admit that there are problems with animal protein. We called it high quality. You know, we said that we had to have it. We enjoyed it. We liked it, and so forth and so on. But in reality, when we consume it, not only do a lot of things start to go wrong, but even more importantly, when we're consuming that we're decreasing the consumption of the foods that we ought to be eating. So it's a little complex, but it's pretty straightforward now.
Okay, that's it from me. Thank you, Dr. Campbell, and I'm going to hand this over to Priya now. Priya will probably have more questions for you.
Okay,
thank
you.
People have sent in. Thank you.
Thank you,
Aziz and Dr. Campbell. I think that was a wonderful talk. I have a list of questions with me. Sent in by our listeners. I'll just read them out so that you can give them your advice. The first question from our listener is, she says that my daughter has a neurofibromatosis type 1, which is a tumor suppressor gene disorder. And aside from the overall benefits of adhering to a whole food plant-based diet, what might be the impact on the prevention of tumors?
You mean of this whole food, plant-based diet? Well, that's what in the earlier question, I was asked that. And I have to be careful. I can't say conclusively that a whole food, plant-based diet can be used to treat cancer for all cancers. But the evidence, lots of evidence, much of it indirect, we have a lot of evidence now to suggest that going on a whole food plant-based diet can actually improve the condition as far as cancer is concerned. And personally, I happen to believe that we're going to, be not too long in the distance, too far in the future, we're going to be actually seeing the same things with cancer as we see with heart disease. The whole food plant-based diet is going to work quite well for cancer people as well. And I told the story about my friend, the physician from Ireland, who just recently published a book, and he was a very skeptical man about this. He was conservative. He didn't want to believe it, but he tried it on his cancer patients, and it seems to be working really well. But I also want to say and be emphatic about that if somebody has cancer, you know, they should certainly stay under the care of their physician. And if the physician is willing to let them give it a try, well, that's fine. It's a free country if they want to try that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. Whole food, plant-based diet can definitely help. That's what that's what Dr. Campbell has been showing us. Yeah. So the next question from our listener is, person asks, is Crohn's disease curable on a whole food, low-fat, plant-based diet?
I don't know that story well enough. I can just pretty much have to rely on my clinical colleagues who have had those kind of patients, and I'm hearing from those who really do work with a whole food plant-based diet, it works really well for the Crohn's disease people too. I know Crohn's disease is kind of a difficult disease, obviously, and it's not easily managed and handled, and it can be very serious for some people, but from the evidence that I hear from my clinical colleagues, they're quite convinced that a whole food plant-based diet really does help a lot, and they completely remove it. So that's about all I can say. Really.
Okay. The next question says, Doctor, how to eat right? The person says, I have intestinal permeability, candida, and small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. I have been told to follow up on a ketogenic diet without fruits and a lot of fats and protein. Would this help?
Well, again, as I say, I'm not a physician. I haven't studied that question. I haven't had patients to know exactly that. But I must tell you that, once again, from the scientific point of view, from the evidence we now have, no, it won't. That's not the way to do it. And that the whole food plant-based diet is it seems to have such a broad effect on a whole variety of responses in the body. And I've given at least 600 lectures here in the United States and abroad, and in the last 10 years, I guess. There's a lot of people come to me and tell me about their situation. It's only anecdotal. I know that's true. But they tell me that, conditions of all kinds that I'm not that familiar with, they say, I tried this and it's just remarkable. Like, I got it behind me and so forth. And then at the same time, this whole food plant-based diet based on biochemistry seems to affect the whole body in so many different ways that I keep hearing about new conditions that I may not know specifically the answer to, but people seem to be responding very well. So I know the opposite of that point of view is what we've been doing for decades now, and that's use pills and procedures to resolve problems. And I'm just really confident of this, that the whole food plant-based diet can do more than all the pills and procedures combined, to create health.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Doctor. The next person is Amber, who's written in, saying, I have been following a whole food plant-based diet for 18 months. I have polycystic ovarian syndrome, and I've lowered my cholesterol, lost weight, and have more energy. But I also have cystic acne that doesn't seem to go away. And she says, I never had an acne problem until starting a whole food plant-based diet, and I have tried everything. Doctor, what is your advice for Amber?
Well, the first thing, I'm assuming this person is not using dairy. That's number one. So when they say that, I'm presuming they're not using dairy. If they are, that can be a source of the problem. But if it's not that, then, some plant-based foods do have allergenic effects. And it's kind of like an allergenic effect. I think the best thing I can say is what's practiced already, has been for a long time, just take out one food at a time, or how they do it during allergies, see if they can discover a certain food disorder related to that. I don't know the answer to that question, obviously. It's just a little trial and error, taking out different foods, see if they get a response. I guess this person has already tried a lot of things, so she's not hearing much from me, not a very good answer, but I just don't know. I just don't know. I think it may resolve itself in due course. I would certainly hope so. Also, a lot of water. She should make sure that she's taking a lot of water. Hydration is very, very important in this whole effort.
The next question is, why do fruit juices sometimes raise triglyceride levels in certain individuals?
Well, that can happen. In fact, fruit juices are not really recommended for the whole food plant-based diet. I mean, it's okay to use them, now and again, but the problem with it, when we, drink the juice, if we will, we in some ways, it's high in sugar, for example, when we drink it, it's a big rush that comes into our stomach. We bypass the first stage of digestion, which occurs in the mouth. When we're eating whole food, we're chewing the food. The saliva has enzymes in it. We're beginning the digestive process in the mouth before it gets to the stomach. And if we drink this already prepared food in the form of juice, you know, high in sugar, then it's kind of overloading the system to some extent, you know, with more sugar than we really need. And that, in turn, when it's using too much of those juices, that can, and there's some evidence that leads to higher triglyceride levels. There's no question about that.
Yeah. The last question for me is, what is the basis of blood type diet, and does it really work? I think we just saw that on your slides about the low-carb diet, this was included. So the person wants to know what is the basis of the blood type diet and whether it works.
Well, that idea was put forth some years ago, and I got the book because I thought, well, this is an interesting idea. I didn't know that much about it. But when I started reading the book, the scientific qualifications and the scientific basis for the discussion was so poor, I just couldn't read on. I mean, the person who wrote the book was actually interested in selling supplements and making recommendations that I don't think were warranted. And he tended to want to believe that it's okay to continue eating the diet we are eating. In fact, for some people, they should be eating this kind of diet. And I was one of the people for type O, I guess it is. I'm supposed to be eating a lot of meat and so forth and so on. This is nonsense. I think the basic blood type diet was kind of an idea, sell books, sell supplements, and make some claims. And it's nothing like the whole food plant-based diet. So I don't really recommend that book.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell. Your presentation study was so thoroughly researched. It's actually very helpful for people to know all this, the science behind what you're eating, and discuss these topics and not just blindly follow that information which is like out there on the internet or hearsay. We have a lot of listeners here today who are cancer survivors too, and I'm sure this information about plant protein and cancer would definitely help them. I would like to leave our listeners with the essence of Dr. Campbell's talk, that closer we are to consuming a whole food, plant-based diet, the healthier we are. Please visit us again, and you can get more details about our show on curetalks.com. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.